Out front next, breaking news. Trump announcing he will testify at his first criminal trial, which begins on Monday. This as he threatens, quote, all hell will break loose on that day. Plus, Mike Johnson showing up in Mar-a-Lago next to Trump, warning about election fraud in 2024. Out front to fact check, the man who the Trump campaign hired to fight fraud in 2020, but he debunked every claim. And Kamala Harris telling Trump to stop the gaslighting when it comes to abortion. This as our K-File unveils the dramatic about-face GOP candidates are taking on this issue. Let's go out front. Good evening, I'm Jim Sciutto, in for Aaron Burnett. Out front tonight, breaking news. Trump to testify. The former president announcing tonight that he will take the stand in his first criminal trial, which begins on Monday.
Plan to testify in your trial in New York?
Yeah, I would testify, absolutely. It's a scam.
I'm
testifying. I tell the truth. I mean, all I can do is tell the truth.
But the truth tonight is, as of tonight, there are no more delays for Trump. The judge in the New York hush money trial just moments ago rejected one of Trump's final requests to delay the trial. This time, Trump claiming the publicity surrounding the trial makes it impossible to begin on time. Judge Juan Merchan ruling, the situation defendant finds himself in now is not new to him and at least in part of his own doing. This says Trump and his team are laser focused on getting just one juror to be on his side. Remember, it needs a unanimous decision or Trump is acquitted.
You know, jury selection is largely luck. It depends who you get.
And an ominous warning tonight from Trump on his website, reading 72 hours until all hell breaks loose. Those words you see in all capital letters. Trump adding, they want me in prison. Paula Reed is out front live in Washington. Paula, Trump, he will be in that courtroom on Monday with the potential jurors. And tonight he says he could testify.
Yeah, he says he could testify, but it remains to be seen if that actually becomes a reality. Sources close to his legal team tell me, yes, that is something they're still exploring. But first of all, they have to seat this jury. And we expect that this will take at least a week. But in talking to sources on both sides of this case, Jim, it's really unclear how far into April or potentially May this process will go. Now, here's how this is going to work. Each day, they'll have a pool of approximately 100 jurors that they will whittle down each day until they can seat 12 jurors and six alternates. Now, going into this process, the Trump team feels that they're already at a disadvantage because of the makeup of the Manhattan jury pool, where they argue that there is a strong anti-Trump bias. But, Jim, as you know, there is a system in place. The system of jury selection is meant to weed out biased jurors, but the Trump team is not convinced that that is going to render a fair jury. Now, here's what they're going to do. Once they have 100 people, they're going to try to strike people for cause, just allow people to raise their hand if they have a vacation or if they don't speak or understand English sufficiently or if they have such a blinding bias against the former president that they couldn't be impartial. Now, tonight, the Trump team is asking the judge to separate out those two groups, people who cannot do this because they are so biased or people who have other logistical or other concerns. Now, in a week of a lot of failed motions from the Trump team, this is a legitimate request, and it's one where they could be successful, Jim. They want to be able to say, potentially, hey, this is how many people we lost because of bias. They're trying to preserve issues on appeal, and I think we're going to see that throughout the process. They're going to be raising issues and making motions, even if they know they won't be successful in the moment, because they're trying to preserve their options for appeal. Now, after they get rid of those folks for cause, then they will randomly select a group of about 18 people. Those folks will face questions from defense attorneys, prosecutors, and the judge. And then the two sides can use each of their 10 preemptive strikes. Now, again, unclear how long this is going to take. And this is the system that is designed to seat a fair jury for most defendants. But, of course, you're not dealing with just any defendant.
And a defendant certainly schooled in the art of delaying the process. Paula Reed, thanks so much. Out front now, Robert Hirschhorn, jury and trial consultant, and Ankush Karduri, he's a former federal prosecutor. Ankush, if I could begin with you, Trump says tonight that he does plan to testify in this case. Of course, whether he shows up, we'll see. Is that a good idea?
It's generally not a good idea for defendants to testify in their own defense in criminal cases. Trump has done this in civil cases, of course, very recently, including the New York Attorney General's civil business fraud trial, E. Jean Carroll's second trial. And those did not go well for him. In fact, I think those efforts were counterproductive and probably made matters worse for him in front of the jury in the AG's case, and the jury in the E. Jean Carroll case, and the judge in the AG's case. So it's not a good idea, but maybe he'll do it.
It's such a great point based on that experience, which we saw play out just very recently. Robert, how could Trump's testimony, in your view, impact the jury?
Yeah, Jim, thanks for having me. Well, look, if he's really getting buried by the evidence in the case, he may not have a choice. Personally, I don't think he ever serves himself well by testifying. He's testifying the E. Jean Carroll. The jury lit him up for a huge verdict. And then in the AG's case, remember, one of the complaints he made is, oh, I should have had a jury. Now that he does have a jury, now that the king of continuance is finally going to have to face a jury, now he's saying that they can't be fair. You got to, you know, he's going to have his work cut out for him. But Jim, all he's got to do is find one. We all got to remember that. Right. If he can get one juror that doesn't vote for guilty, then he's won.
Ankush, Trump failed tonight in yet another attempt to delay the trial, in this case over pretrial publicity. But you did hear Paula's reporting there, more challenges from the president's legal team expected next week. Some of that, as she explained, setting up for a possible appeal. But I wonder, is there anything you can think of that Trump's team could do now to stop this case from moving forward, even after it begins on Monday?
Nothing that would work, or nothing that should work. This trial should proceed on Monday and go forward. But of course, Trump and his lawyers often try highly unusual things, including all of the efforts this week to try to prevent this trial from going forward. Several of them were highly unusual and new to me. They all flopped. So it wouldn't surprise me if he tries more of that, him and his lawyers, maybe even going to the Supreme Court after the trial has begun. I wouldn't expect that to work, but I also wouldn't be surprised if they keep doing it.
Robert, so Monday, Trump, he's going to be face-to-face with these potential jurors in that courtroom. He'll be there for jury selection. I wonder, how could that impact what the potential jurors say, how they behave? I wonder if you've seen a parallel to this that might give us a sense of that.
Yeah, well, he's the most famous person in the world. And when you've come face to face with somebody that's got that kind of charisma, that kind of power, it tends to be intimidating, it tends to be shocking, it tends to be exciting. But here's the thing, Jim. As long as the judge says to the jurors, look, we don't want you to tell us what you think we want to hear. Just tell us how you honestly think and feel about this case, this defendant. That's the best chance that this judge is going to have for getting a fair jury. But make no mistake about it. He's going to lose the vast majority of the jurors, either for hardship trial, they just can't serve that long, or because they've already formed an opinion about former President Trump or the case. So he's going to go through a bunch of jurors. We'll know by the end of Monday what the pace looks like and how long it'll take to pick this jury.
That's a great point. We'll be watching for that first day. Robert, Ankush, thanks so much to both of you. And out front now, former Republican Congressman Ken Buck of Colorado. He just retired from Congress before his term was over, saying the dysfunction was worse than he ever saw in more than 9 years in Washington. Congressman, thanks so much for taking the time this evening.
Thanks for appreciate it.
I wonder what your view is of the politics of this first criminal trial, the hush money trial. I mean, there are some who say that, well, he will be seen as a victim of all this. But I wonder how politically damaging you think this could be, because there will be some damaging evidence before in that courtroom.
There will be damaging evidence. You know, a lot of people on the right have made up their mind they're going to support him. A lot of people on the left have made up their mind they won't support him. The key to me is the essence of this case has to do with Donald Trump having an extramarital affair, paying a woman to have that affair, and then paying that woman to not talk about the affair during the campaign for president in 2016. That will turn off a lot of Republican evangelical Christian voters. And I think they will be hard pressed to support this president, regardless of whether they get whether he is convicted or not convicted.
It's important to remind folks of the essence of this case, where it began, as you did there. Speaker Johnson, as you know, he just stood next to Trump at Mar-a-Lago, and they spoke about, quote unquote, election integrity. They did it amid an ongoing threat from Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene to oust Johnson from office. Trump just asked who he supports in this feud. I want to play his answer and get your thoughts.
It's not not an easy situation for any speaker. I think he's doing a very good job. He's doing about as good as you're going to do. And I'm sure that Marjorie understands that. She's a very good friend of mine. And I know she has a lot of respect for the speaker. I stand with the speaker. We've had a very good relationship.
Green certainly not letting up, saying she still doesn't support Johnson. And certainly the former president may calculate that having another feud just doesn't support his own reelection chances or election chances in the fall. Do you think Democrats may have to jump in to save the Republican speaker?
Well, I think President Trump gave Speaker Johnson about as good an endorsement as President Trump could possibly give. And I think the message was directed at Marjorie Taylor Greene, and I think she got the message. If she does file this motion to vacate, I do think that there will be 4, 5, 10 Republicans who will vote to vacate the speaker. The only way the speaker keeps his job in that situation is if he gets Democrat votes. He may very well get those votes because he's putting a Ukraine bill on the floor, a funding bill on the floor. And that is something that the Democrats want and have signed a discharge petition for. He has passed bipartisan spending legislation. So I think there's a good chance that he will get Democrat votes and survive this motion to vacate.
And many Republican lawmakers want that Ukraine aid bill to get a vote on the floor, too. Earlier today, Green offered Trump the following advice ahead of his meeting with Johnson. Have a listen to that.
He doesn't need to be worrying about what Mike Johnson's trying to talk him into and Mike Johnson's trying to saddle up to him because he's scared of a motion to vacate. Mike Johnson needs to do his job and leave President Trump alone and let him win this election.
So she's mad at Johnson, as she referenced there, because she believes he might support more Ukraine aid, which we should note a large majority of House members do support. Trump just said he is at least looking at it, may consider it if it's in the form of a loan. Given that, do you think Green, who you nicknamed Moscow Marjorie, which is catching on, by the way, do you think she could change her tune, support more aid, but more importantly, that Congress will, that it'll get a vote on this and get this aid to Ukraine as it needs it?
If this bill goes to the floor, it absolutely passes. I think Marjorie Taylor Greene should follow her own advice. She has never been near President Trump where she hasn't taken an opportunity to have a photo op. And I believe that Mike Johnson, as the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, has every right to visit with the presidential nominee from his party and come to some agreement so that this president is running on the same platform that the Republicans in the House are willing to pass.
Congressman Ken Buck, appreciate you joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And out front next, Trump and House Speaker Mike Johnson pushing new and baseless conspiracy theories tonight about the 2024 election before a single vote has even been cast. We're going to fact check him line by line. It's important. Plus, Vice President Kamala Harris just eviscerating Trump, accusing him of gaslighting the American public when it comes to abortion, as our K-File is uncovering a growing number of Republicans who are now frantically flip-flopping on that very issue. And breaking news, the U.S. is now moving assets into the Middle East, additional ones, as President Biden warns tonight. He expects Iran to strike Israel and sue.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Breaking news, with Donald Trump by his side, embattled House Speaker Mike Johnson pushing a ban on non-U.S. citizens voting in federal elections. This, despite a law stating exactly that already long on the books. Johnson also claimed without evidence that Democrats are allowing migrants to cross the border to turn them into Democratic voters.
The House Republicans are introducing a bill that will require proof of citizenship to vote. It seems like common sense. I'm sure all of us would agree. We only want U.S. citizens to vote in U.S. elections. But there are some Democrats who don't want to do that. We believe that one of their designs, one of the reasons for this open border, which everybody asks all around the country, why would they do this? Why would they allow all this chaos? Why the violence? Because they want to turn these people into voters.
Not really evidence of that. Johnson rushed down to Mar-a-Lago for this so-called election integrity press conference with Trump as he's fighting simply to keep the speaker's job. Out front now, Ken Block. He was hired by the Trump campaign to investigate election fraud claims in 2020 and debunked each claim put in front of him. He's also the author of the new book, Disproven. Also with me, Stephen Richer. He's the Maricopa County Recorder in Arizona, one of the Republicans who fought back against Trump's efforts to overturn the election. Thanks to both of you for joining tonight, and thanks for your candor throughout all this.
Of course.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Stephen, first to you. You oversee the largest county in Arizona. That county, that state, could very well decide who wins and loses the election. So I wonder what you say to the claims you just heard there.
Well, I agree as a matter of public policy, and Arizonans agree, and I think probably most Americans agree that only United States citizens should be voting in elections and that we should show documented proof of citizenship. But in Arizona, we're already 99% of the way there. We require proof of citizenship to be able to vote a full ballot. We keep track of those who don't provide proof of citizenship. And I think the problem with this is the implication that it had any impact on a past election, or that if not passed, it would have an implication for a future election. And there's just no data or evidence to support that.
Ken, to that point, Johnson warned that the number of non-citizens voting could very well impact the election results in November. I want to play that and then get to some facts.
There's so many millions of illegals in the country that if only one out of 100 voted, they would cast potentially hundreds of thousands of votes in the election. That could turn an election. This could be a tight election in our congressional races around the country. It could, if there are enough votes, affect the presidential election. And so that's why House Republicans are going to act.
I mean, the fact is, these things have been investigated over many, many years, single-digit cases of this over many millions of votes. You investigated non-citizens voting in 2020 for the Trump campaign. In your work, did you find any evidence of large numbers of non-citizens voting in the 2020 election?
We didn't. And in fact, in Arizona, I was provided a list of 2,500 voters who somebody somewhere suspected were non-citizens, and I was asked to determine, if I could, whether they were citizens or not. It's extremely difficult to do. In fact, it's impossible to do in a way that would provide evidence that would stand up in court. which makes all of these claims so remarkable to me because, like so many claims of voter fraud that I did debunk, there was no foundation. There was no foundation of fact behind them. They were more someone's. Someone suspected that something bad was happened would happen, but they didn't have any direct proof that something bad was actually happening.
Yeah, and like 4 years later, we're still talking about it. Stephen, here is some of what Donald Trump said just before Johnson spoke.
We have an election problem, and that's really what we're here to talk about today. We want to also mention election interference, and we want to talk about election integrity.
The fact is, again, as we keep saying, those claims, they've been debunked for years. How worried are you that Trump is already planting the seeds to say that there was fraud in the 2024 election, much as he did in 2020, and before a single ballot has even been cast?
Yeah, it's disappointing. I would say let's have the election first, and you might surprise yourself and see how things go. But to the point of Arizona, again, we do require documented proof of citizenship for a full ballot. And over 99% of Arizonans have done that. And that's true of many other states. And also, we have to remember what the original law is, the original policy. It is against the law in every single state in the country to vote in a federal election if you are not a United States citizen. That seems like a poor cost-benefit analysis to be an additional one vote in over 3 million votes cast in the Arizona presidential election and run the risk of a felony that would then lead to deportation? I'm not seeing that.
Yeah, listen, it's such a good point to make. Ken, our Marshall Cohen reported today that Johnson was one of Trump's biggest fighters in trying to overturn the election in the days back in 2020. Here are just a few examples of the basic claims that he pushed at the time.
I think all of us know intuitively that there was a lot amiss about this election day. The allegations about these voting machines, some of them being rigged with this software by Dominion. Look, there's a lot of merit to that. They know that in Georgia, it really was rigged. I'm saying that the system is set up for massive fraud and error and irregularity.
Just not true. According to the record, by the way, Dominion had to pay. There were a lot of money had to be paid to Dominion for spreading false claims like that. He went on to say in that same interview that the problem with every election fraud case is that they are notoriously difficult to prove. So to you, as someone who debunked each and every election fraud claim made by the Trump campaign and brought to you, what do you say to Speaker Johnson now?
Yeah, I am somebody who has delivered actual hard evidence of some voter fraud. I anticipated some deceased votes that were cast before they were cast. I've identified confirmed duplicate voters where individuals have voted in two different states. I've delivered evidence that stands up in court. Speaker Johnson is an attorney, and he should know better. He should understand that hearsay evidence, which is what he's talking about, does not stand up in court, and it should not ever rise to the level that it is right now, where we're impugning our election integrity and our infrastructure based on hearsay, which is what he's doing.
And listen, by the way, that's what happened. Trump made a lot of claims back in 2020, and when those claims went to court, they didn't stand up in court. To both of you, gentlemen, you did the work. You spoke the truth. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Out front next, Trump's pivot on abortion is creating major headaches for Republicans who once said this.
For me, there's no compromise on abortion.
I would move to have a national ban on abortion.
But as our K-File has uncovered, that is not what they are saying now. Quite the opposite. Plus, I'm going to speak to a Democratic strategist who predicted all the talking heads were wrong about a, quote, red wave in 2022. He was right. Now he is confident that Biden is going to win. Tonight, enough with the gaslighting. Those are the words of Vice President Kamala Harris just moments ago, eviscerating former President Donald Trump at a rally in Arizona.
Now, Trump wants us to believe he will not sign a national ban. Enough with the gaslighting. Enough with the gaslighting.
This as Trump himself tonight refused to answer if he is pro-choice or pro-life.
You have both considered yourself pro-choice and pro-life. Which one is it?
Well, you know exactly which one it is.
Well, Trump has switched his position on this 15 times. CNN's K-File finding example after example of Republicans following Trump's lead, downplaying past anti-abortion stances or switching them completely. Out front now, Andrew Kaczynski, senior editor of CNN's K-File. So Andrew, let's begin with a couple of examples of well-known names running for statewide office.
Yeah, so we examined more than a dozen competitive races around the country at various levels, House, Senate, Governor. And what we found repeatedly was Republicans shifting their positions or downplaying them. In some cases, these changes have been subtle, but in other cases, they've been rather overt, with candidates reversing course on supporting outright abortion bans or even denying they ever opposed it. And I want to walk our viewers through some of them. Let's take Carrie Lake. She is running for Senate in Arizona. Now, the Arizona Supreme Court this week ruled that an 1864 law banning nearly all abortions in the state must be upheld. But back when Lake ran a failed bid for governor in 2022, listen to what she said about the law.
I'm incredibly thrilled that we are going to have a great law that's already on the books. I believe it's ARS 133603. So it will prohibit abortion in Arizona except to save the life of a mother. And I think we're going to be paving the way and setting course for other states to follow.
So now Lake says she opposes that near total ban on abortion. Here's what her campaign told us, saying that Carrie is personally pro-life. Her position on a federal ban is clear. She opposes it just like President Trump. Carrie is opposed to the territorial law and is calling on the state legislature to fix the issue. Her focus is on saving babies and helping women through protecting IVF, baby bonuses, child tax credit, and paid family leave. So she now says she opposes that territorial ban, even though she previously did say she supported it. She even knew the state law's exact statute. So that is just a complete 180 on the issue. Now, there's also Mark Robinson. He's a lieutenant governor in North Carolina, and he's now running to be governor. Now, he repeatedly backed a ban on abortion without exceptions for rape or incest before the Dobbs decision, and once regularly labeled abortion as a murder and genocide, and even compared the anti-abortion movement to the abolitionist movement to end slavery. Listen to Robinson at one event in July 2020.
For me, there is no compromise on abortion. It makes no difference to me why or how that child ended up in that womb.
Flash forward to today, Jim, and Robinson has said he avoids using what he calls, quote, the A word entirely, and he denies his past support for bans without exceptions, with his campaign telling CNN, quote, as governor, he would sign a heartbeat bill with exceptions for rape, incest, and when the life of the mother is in danger.
Yeah, well, those previous answers are on tape. You also looked at congressional races and found this is happening all over the country.
Jim, that's right. And there might not be a clearer example in all of the ones we looked through than Joe Kent. He is the Republican running for Congress in Washington in a swing seat. Look at what he said in July 2022. He said, I would move to have a national ban on abortions. Now, look at this comment he made on Twitter in January. He said, post-Dobbs decision, it's a state issue. I don't support a national ban on abortion. So just he said one thing and he said the complete opposite. And something that's really interesting about all this, Jim, is we're seeing a lot of these candidates, and you saw Kent right there as a great example, who are citing state laws in trying to get around discussing this issue. But in theory, they are getting elected to positions where they could change the law. Trump has said he won't sign a national abortion ban, but he previously signed on to a 20-week ban at the federal level. So it's really going to be up to voters now to see whether they want to take candidates at their words on these changes.
Yeah, and you put the record before them. Andrew Kaczynski, thanks so much. Out front now, Democratic strategist Simon Rosenberg. He's been involved in presidential campaigns for the last 36 years and confidently predicts that President Biden will beat Donald Trump in 2024. He's gone against conventional wisdom before. It was right, we should know, predicting Republicans would not get that much talked about red wave in 2022. Of course, they did not. Simon, thanks so much for joining tonight.
It's great to be here, Jim.
So, as you know, Vice President Harris in Arizona just hammering Republicans on that anti-abortion law there, 160-year-old anti-abortion law. Yeah. And as we just heard in that K-File report, Republicans are now scrambling to change their positions. They clearly see a vulnerability here. Is this going to be the issue Democrats win on, in your view?
I think the election changed this week. I think it's been a very, very bad week for the Republican Party because it's a confirmation that MAGA, the threat that MAGA poses to fundamental rights and liberties in the United States is ongoing. It's not something that happened before. It's growing and it's becoming even more dangerous. I mean, millions of women in Arizona and Florida in the next few weeks are going to lose fundamental rights and liberties that women have had here in the United States for over 50 years and is common throughout the modern world. And so if you were scared of MAGA in 2018 and 2020 and 2022 and 2023, when Democrats won all these elections all across the country, MAGA 2024 is an even more dangerous and scary iteration of MAGA. And so I think it's going to be, this is going to reinforce, I think, the extremism of the Republican Party in a way that's going to be very damaging to them in this election.
Yeah, I suppose you could look at some of those reversals from Republicans as a sign that they see that as well. You say President Biden is being underestimated right now, and you point to some new poll numbers, including this one right here. The Ipsos Reuters poll has Biden leading Trump 41-37%. Still within the margin of error, but you're confident things are going to swing Biden's way. Tell us why.
Yeah, so my basic take on the election is that Joe Biden is a good president. The country is better off. He's got a very strong case for re-election. The Democratic Party is strong, unified, raising tons of money, winning elections all across the country. And the Republicans have Trump, who I think is the ugliest political figure that we've seen in modern times. And I think that everything that we need to do to win is within the normal bounds of what a political party has to be able to do in a campaign. I think making Trump look like a serious candidate for president again is going to be very difficult. I think he's far more degraded than he was. I think his performance on the stump is far weaker than it was in 2020. He's got all the baggage from the trials and all the crimes that he committed in recent years. And his own agenda is far more extreme. I want to say one thing about abortion here and what the Republicans are trying to do by claiming that they're going to let it go back to the states. When you say that, then you're embracing Idaho's law. Right. Which has no exceptions for rape or incest or anything else. You're embracing six-week abortion bans. You're embracing and validating the most extreme abortion positions in the country. They think that's a safe haven for them. Mm. It's actually an endorsement of the most extreme abortion restrictions in the country. And so I do think that the Republicans now, in my own view, is that what's happening in the polling, and I think many of us, including those in the campaign, believe that what would happen in the election is that as the general election began and it became clear that it was Biden versus Trump and the Biden campaign turned on, that Biden would start to gain in the polls. And that's what you're seeing right now. We've got a long way to go, but I would much rather be us than them 7 months out.
Simon Rosenberg, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jim.
Out front next, a CNN exclusive. We travel to the southern border with Mexican authorities who tonight are growing impatient with U.S. officials. Plus, breaking news, the U.S. on high alert as President Biden says he now expects Iran to strike Israel and soon. So what might such an attack look like?
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Tonight, as pressure mounts for President Biden to take action at the southern border, former President Trump outlandishly claims that millions of migrants are entering the country from prisons.
They come from jails and prisons. They come from mental institutions and insane asylums. They've taken the gang members, the leaders and the members, and they've deposited them very nicely into the United States of America.
similar to what he said back in 2016. Frankly, there is zero evidence to support those claims, we should note. It comes as our David Culver got unprecedented access to Mexican officials who are, they say, growing impatient with their U.S. counterparts. David Culver is out front.
You can see behind me here, there's a huge gap in the wall. And this is where Mexican officials tell us that a lot of the smugglers are either directing or bringing some of the migrants too, so that they can easily cross.
Which makes these rugged back roads the preferred and profitable routes for cartel-backed migrant smugglers. Okay. We're about an hour east of Tijuana, driving with Mexican migration officials along the U.S.-Mexico border. But we detour after learning a group of migrants has been rescued, as officials here say.
Hey, donde son?
Brazil.
We pull up and find about a dozen folks who described to me their attempts to claim asylum in the U.S.
And he said he tried to cross, but Mexican officials stopped him from being able to go.
That's because Mexico is now stepping up its efforts to stop migrants from crossing illegally into the U.S.
We don't know if it was on that.
Following requests from the Biden administration, Mexico is now pouring resources, like the National Guard and Mexican Army, in to help patrol and detain migrants like these, eventually transporting them to southern Mexico.
Where we separate them by nationalities, and then from them we determine the deportation process.
What's happening here goes beyond stepped-up patrols. In recent months, Mexican officials have built base camps, deploying troops to some of the most popular illegal crossing sites.
Hey, smuggler's van. Are there several of these vehicles just left abandoned? And
like seven vehicles in total?
In this area.
In the area.
As we pull up, we realize we've been here before.
We've seen so many people cross through this property. This right here.
Uh-huh.
At this spot late last year, we met U.S. residents fed up with migrants coming through their land.
They can come through the front door.
Our cameras captured hundreds each day and night.
That has stopped in recent weeks, and it stopped primarily because of what we're seeing on the Mexico side of things. This is a remote base on the border. You've got Mexican immigration officials, you've got National Guard, and you've got Mexican Army who are here 24/7.
We have our fridge, microwave, coffee, everything.
You have moved resources to live 24/7 on the border. Why is it so important for Mexico to be doing that?
We want to prevent migrants to get in touch with the criminal groups.
The number of migrant encounters reported by U.S. Border Patrol appears to reflect the impact of Mexico's actions, dropping 42% from December to January alone and seeming to stay low. But officials warn cartels and their smugglers frequently adjust their tactics and keep close watch.
They're watching us right now.
They see when we are patrolling and when we leave a spot.
It's a crisis that has also sparked uneasiness for Mexican residents.
It's gotten so frustrating for these folks in particular that the community got together, wrote a letter to their governor petitioning for more resources. And it's for that reason that you have, well, you can see right here, members of the Mexican National Guard who are now patrolling neighborhoods like this one to keep migrants from coming through.
Authorities here urge migrants to use the U.S.'s CBP1 app rather than to risk crossing with smugglers. Mexican officials at this location even help pre-screen up to 500 migrants daily for the U.S. asylum interview process.
So he's in communication with U.S. officials, por otro lado, and on the other side, and they're sending documents back and forth to make sure that they have the right information.
While this is a more orderly way to claim asylum, it can take a while to get an appointment. Marta Achila says she's waited 5 months for this day.
Pero no quisieron usar un coyote para cruzar.
Ay, pues no
directamente.
Tenemos dinero.
Y quieren trabajar legalmente allá
sí,
en los Estados Unidos.
Entonces, eso queremos.
So I asked why they didn't go through the smuggling route, which so many choose to do. Vamos a caminar con ustedes. And she said that, for one, it costs an extreme amount of money. And the other aspect of it for her was they wanted to be able to enter legally through the appointment, try to build a better future there.
The road ahead is uncertain for both the migrants and for those protecting the border. We see that firsthand as we leave the remote border camps.
The reason we've stopped and pulled over is because there are these spikes that we've noticed all along the different dirt roadways that take us to the border wall.
Evidence of a smuggler's desperate attempt to salvage their profits.
There are dozens, if not hundreds, of these.
And while it slows them down momentarily, for now, they forge ahead in their efforts to curb the flow of a migrant crisis that's consuming resources on both sides of the border.
They have great reporting. As we saw in the story, Mexican officials are expanding efforts to stem the flow of migrants into the U.S. We're seeing some effect in the numbers there, as you noted. How could U.S. politics derail those efforts, though?
I think, Jim, the biggest threat to this bolstered support, which is, as you're seeing, actually helping lower the numbers of migrants crossing right. illegally into the U.S., comes at the shifting of policies. And that's policies on immigration matters that not only come at the federal level here in the U.S., but also at the state's level. So Mexico gets increasingly frustrated when they see policies come out of states like Texas or Iowa. And for them, that adds domestic pressures that during an election year, not only in the U.S., but also in Mexico, could cause them to have to then redirect those efforts, so to speak, and move those resources elsewhere. So if they feel like it's just going to add more problems on the Mexico side of things, they'll quickly abandon this added effort and put those National Guards and Mexican military elsewhere.
David Culver, thanks so much. Out front next, breaking news. U.S. officials are now telling CNN Iran appears to be moving military assets into position, assets including drones and cruise missiles. This is Biden says he expects Tehran to strike sooner rather than later. Breaking news, CNN just learning the U.S. has observed Iran moving military assets. One source says Iran is readying as many as 100 cruise missiles. This comes as President Biden says he expects Iran to attack Israel, quote, sooner rather than later. The U.S. and the entire Mideast is bracing for retaliation after multiple Iranian officials were killed in an airstrike in Syria, which Iran blames on Israel. Alex Marquardt is out front tonight. And Alex, the president says he expects an imminent attack from Iran. Based on U.S. intelligence assessment, when could this happen and what might it look like?
Well, Jim, the time frame we're hearing from the president there, that echoes what we've been hearing for days from sources and experts, that this is likely something that is imminent that could happen in the coming hours and days. But what this looks like, what happens and where, those are the million-dollar questions. We have some worrying new reporting from our colleagues Oren Lieberman and Natasha Bertrand that just came in, that U.S. intelligence is seeing military assets being moved around by Iran, specifically drones and cruise missiles. One source saying that they're readying as many as 100 cruise missiles. That can mean a number of different things. They're posturing. They're trying to deter Iran, but it could also mean that they're preparing an attack from Iranian soil. That would be the first time during this war. That would be a very significant move by Iran. But there are a number of different scenarios that we could see. We've also heard intelligence officials and experts talking about the possibility of proxy groups in neighboring countries carrying out waves of attacks using rockets, missiles, drones against military targets inside Israel. Because this is a retaliation against an alleged diplomatic post, Iran could carry out attacks against Israeli embassies around the world. One thing we do not expect to happen, Jim, is Iran going after U.S. targets. That is something that the U.S. has warned against. But the U.S. very much is helping Israel prepare for what may come, saying that they are prepared to help Israel intercept anything that is incoming into Israel. And the top U.S. general for the Middle East, General Eric Kirilla, he's been in Israel for several days preparing for this variety of scenarios. Jim?
No question. And some of those assets being moved into the region are specifically for that task of potentially shooting down anything incoming. Just briefly, Alex, the U.S. and Iran have been communicating directly and indirectly. To what end?
Well, both public and private messages from Iran to the United States essentially saying stay out of it, that this is between us and Israel. The U.S. has responded saying that you should not go after U.S. targets and don't escalate the situation. And that is a message that Iran has been getting from a number of different corners, from the Europeans, from the Arabs. To what extent they will listen remains to be seen. We could expect a very calculated but very significant retaliation by Iran. Jim?
No question. We know all eyes are watching right now. Alex Marquardt, thanks so much for joining.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN Flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country,
Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.